me before, but twice today, my microphone has popped off and become like a tail. Just kind of been walking with that. That's never happened before, so that's been kind of entertaining for me as I kind of have to waddle around trying to figure that out and then trying to figure out how to put it back together. So that's just, a little day in the life of Randy, just because I know that's really what y'all are interested in hearing about just for a minute. So it's been quite that kind of morning. I think it probably has something to do with having been on the youth retreat for the last three days and just being a little bit toward exhausted. So probably has something to do with that. Lindsay, thank you so much. Thank you for sharing with us. And I hope everyone gets the challenge here. I know this is going to be hard for us as Baptists, but the challenge this week is to go and eat. I mean, really, go and eat. I mean, that's your challenge. On Wednesday night, if at all possible, go to Chihuahua's and pick up some good Mexican food or eat it there and tell them you're with First Baptist Preschool, and that's your job. Go and eat. The great news, I'd recommend this, is you can call a few friends. Take them with you. Have a good time. Take your work associates there after work and let them go with First Baptist Preschool. It's a great way to support things this week. Lindsay, thank you for being here, and we do look forward to our folks getting to know you a little bit and share with you after the service. Couple of things, trying to get a couple of thoughts in order here. Our family's going to be going on vacation tomorrow. We've got some family members that we have not seen since the beginning of the pandemic, and we want to go and reconnect with them as we go. We're going to go a couple places on the way, but then we're going to connect with family. The good news is we're going to Georgia, which is close to Florida, and all the Delta variant stuff is really going up. So we're very excited about that, tongue-in-cheek completely. So you'll see that I'm wearing my mask a whole lot more. We know what our governor has said about recommended mask wearing now inside, even if we're vaccinated. Nothing has changed at our church right now as of this moment. Right now, it's still if you are vaccinated, you can be inside without a mask. That's our church policy and has been the last few months. If you are unvaccinated, you need to wear a mask inside the building. That's been our policy for the last few months, so we're still with that. If something changes, we will change, and we will roll with that. But certainly we're trying to be safe. We're encouraging people to get vaccinated, encouraging people on those fronts. But I ask for your prayers for our family as we travel. We've got some traveling to do. We're going to see family. It's going to be good, but we're trying to stay safe as well. So we would greatly appreciate your prayers as we do that. Mentioning the youth retreat, I'm so grateful for all the folks that made that happen. It was a wonderful 3 days at Eagle Eyrie. Wonderful 3 days of bliss, laughter, presence with the Lord, connection with God changing us and challenging us, and just utter, complete, full-on exhaustion. So it was, and it was hot too. I don't know if I mentioned that. It was hot. But our youth did a great job. I want to thank our chaperones who went with us. We had two college chaperones, Kirsten Gray and James Shepley, went with us. We had one of our deacons, Kevin Prusher, went and took one for the team and was willing to go and be a part of that as well. And then one of our Hispanic leaders, she's a part of our Hispanic worship team and is part of one of the youth leaders in our Hispanic congregation, Nikki Acevedo, was with us, and she did a fabulous job. And then Colby Keller, her first youth retreat as our summer youth minister, did a fantastic job. So when you see these folks, when you see all of us that were there, when you see us dragging a little slow, thinking a little slow, just know it was for a good cause. So I have our sermon this morning. We're going to start with Luke 15, 1 through 2. And for those of you watching who watched at 8:30, because we do have some folks who watch online at 8:30 and at 10:30, this one's going to be a little bit different because in the spirit of not being fully myself today, I walked up this morning at 8:30 and pulled my sermon out to begin to preach and realized I had last Sunday's sermon. Not making this up. This really happened. And so I had one of those moments of prayer. I mean, normally this is a cheat sheet for me. I'm not reading word for word. So my memory was what I had to rely on. And you know what? I did pretty well. There was one story that I forgot that I wanted to make sure we include. But sometimes that's how it goes. So that's just kind of the way it is. So Let's start with these two verses that we've started with the last two Sundays as we keep moving with this Just Jesus series. These two verses, Luke 15, 1 through 2, I think we've got them for the screen for you that I want us to see. These two verses, now the Pharisees, the tax collectors, and the sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." This is Luke 15, 1 through 2. It is the starting place for all that comes after. Three stories, one rapid fire right after the other, that teach about the incredible mercy and grace of God. The first is a story about a shepherd looking for one lost sheep out of 100. The next one is a story of a woman who's lost one coin out of 10. And then the final story, the one that's the most well-known, is the story of a man who has two sons, and one goes off to a far country. After taking half of his father's livelihood, and he goes and he spends it on wild living, and then he spends all of it and finds himself alone and devastated and having no food, and he ends up taking a job with pigs, now real pigs, and ends up taking this job to feed the pigs. And the text tells us that he came to his senses and said, "Even the servants of my father's house have more than I do here. I'm going to go to my father's house, tell him, I have done wrong. I have sinned against you, Father. I've sinned against God. I know I can't be your son anymore, but please, let me be one of your hired hands, and I'll spend the rest of my life working hard for you." He goes home to try and make that pitch, and he doesn't even get there before his father sees him from a long way off, and he runs after him, throws his arms around him. The son tries to get out his apology, and he can't get it out at all because his father is wrapping him up in hugs, pulling him into the house, getting a robe and getting a ring for his finger and telling everybody, "My son was lost, and now he's found. My son was dead, and he's alive again. Let's have a party." And they start the party. That's the story. Three stories in succession. The story of the lost sheep, the story of the lost coin, and the story of the prodigal sons. But wait a minute. There's only one prodigal son. The young guy who ran off. No, friend. It's the story of the prodigal sons. Because there's another son. There's an older brother. This older brother was the one who did everything right. He made straight A's in high school and went to a great college. He had been the captain of the football team. He was well liked by everyone he was around. He always did all of his chores at home. He was always the one that did it the right way. He went off to college, graduated summa cum laude, went and got his master's degree, and came home and decided he was going to spend his life helping run the family business. And so day in and day out, he got up early and he stayed late and he worked with his dad trying to make the business run and flourish. It was a farming business. It was hard work, but slowly and surely they prospered and they grew, and everything worked because of his effort and energy and education. Everybody wanted their son to be like this guy. He was one of the youngest deacons elected in their church. He was highly respected. He was a member of the Rotary Club. He was what everyone in society thought a good young man should be. When his younger brother pulled this crazy stunt and left, the older brother stayed. He continued doing his work, and he did the work of the younger brother as well. Through perseverance and determination, he managed, with the father's help, to pull the company back from financial ruin. After all, not many companies survive when they lose half of their capital and half of what they have on one day. Because that's what happened when the younger son said, "Father, give me half of what I would get when you die." So the father gave it to him. The older brother worked hard. He helped his father. They kept the business going, and finally they began to prosper again. They hired new workers, purchased new oxen, grew new crops, got new livestock. Famines in the new countries nearby actually helped grow their business because they had food and folks would come and purchase from them. And somehow this older son, along with his father, had gotten things back together. Eventually, the older brother just wrote off the younger brother. He says to himself, I hope he figures things out, but he's made his choices. We figured it out. We don't need him here. We've grown even more prosperous than we were before. We figured it out. We can make this work. And honestly, it's kind of nice to not have to listen to his whining and listen to his griping. One day, the older brother had a long day. One of the machines had broken in the furthest field, and he had to spend time during the day fixing that. While he was working on the machine, he got a call on his cell phone that a couple of workers were not going to be coming in that day. As a matter of fact, they weren't going to be coming in for 14 days because they tested positive for COVID. And then he had a new worker that had just been hired that didn't show up at all. And then he had another new worker that actually did show up and was an eager worker but didn't know how to do anything. So he had to spend time with that onboarding process. And if you ever have brought anybody new onto your company or had a new coworker come along, you know it takes time for people to get up to speed, even when they're smart and they know what to do. So this had been his day, and he had started early at 5 in the morning, and he was coming back to the house at around 8 o'clock p.m., and he was exhausted. All he wanted that night was a shower, Netflix, and DoorDash. When he got home, the house was filled with everyone he knew and a lot of people he didn't know. There were neighbors. There were relatives. There was food cooking outside at the barbecue pit. There was a DJ spinning over in the corner. There were drinks. There was laughter. There was shouting. There was joy. And there was wall-to-wall people. Obviously, the party had been going on for a couple of hours already. He called one of the employees over and said, "What is going on?" The employee said, "Your brother, he has come home and your father has arranged a huge celebration. Your father is so excited. Your brother has come home, and all he can walk around saying is, my son was lost, and now he's found." The older brother, you know how the story goes. The older brother was overjoyed. He rushed into the home, rubbing his sweaty self up against all the people crowded in there until he found his brother, and he gave him a big brotherly bear hug, and his younger brother said, "You smell." And the older brother said, "Well, you kind of do too." And they laughed and they cried and they reunited in reconciliation. But that's not what happened, is it? You know what happened. The text tells us the older brother became angry and he refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. Next slide. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been working for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never even gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours," notice he didn't say this brother of mine, "when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you've kill the fatted calf for him." "My son," the father said, "you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." And we're left with this being the end of the story. The story starts with one boy leaving the house. The story ends with the other boy outside the house. I wonder if the other boy is ever going to come home. Resentment and bitterness runs deep in the older brother. He has watched what the younger brother's departure has done to his father. He has seen his father gray quicker. He has seen him stoop lower. He has seen the sorrow wear at his father's wit, his memory, and his laughter. He's noticed his father spending a good portion of every afternoon aimlessly walking to the end of the driveway and then looking with a forlorn expression down both sides of the road, hoping that he would see the young son that has wandered off. The older son worked harder to protect the father from financial ruin and to hopefully shield him from emotional breakdown. The older brother loves his father so much that the younger brother's disrespect and disdain for him has angered the older brother deeply. He resents what his brother has done to his father, and now his father has gone soft. Welcoming in this younger brother, the one who stole his money, his health, and the stability of their family, the older brother thinks that his brother deserves punishment, not pardon. The older brother is livid, and he vents to his father. He says, "This scoundrel of a son has nearly ruined your finances. He nearly ruined your emotional health, your mental stability. He spent his last few years chasing pleasure and prostitutes while I was caring for you and rebuilding your business. Now he wants to show up and act like he's sorry. And you open up freely and give him the best that we have. You give him a party. He hasn't earned a party." If anyone around here has earned a party, it's me. I've been faithful. I've done life right. I've stuck by your rules. I've lived the way that I should. I will not come into the house because this, what you're doing for my younger brother, for your younger son, is not fair. And the father responds to his oldest son, "You're right. It's not fair. It's grace. Because your younger brother was dead, and he's alive again. Son, I love you, and you have always lived in the joy of my house." Some folks might suggest that that's the father taking his son for granted. No, he's simply saying, "You're always in my love. My love always covers you." But understand that your brother walked away from that love, the love you've always held dear, and now he has walked back. We have to celebrate. The loving father longs for both boys to simply come home, to live in the joy of the grace of God. And yet the story closes with the older brother farther away from the love of the father than the son who threw his life away with prostitutes. The Pharisees listening to Jesus, they knew exactly where they were in the story. They were the older brother. They were the ones with the rigid religious laws who had decided the tax collectors and sinners, they had written them off and said they had no need to even try and come back home, because they don't belong. For them, their religion had become only for the insiders who did all the right things. They were mad at everyone else. It was a religion of refusing grace to tax collectors, sinners, prodigals, and lost ones, and refusing to extend grace to others. The Pharisees and religious leaders had lost the way of God for themselves. One of the worst things that can happen to a church is losing the way of grace. We think that the worst things that can happen to a church is losing members, losing money, having less people present. We think those are the worst things that happen to a church. Nowhere close. The worst things that happen to a church, the worst thing that can happen to a church is to live as a people of ungrace. Is to live as a people that refuses grace to people that are in need and in pain and looking for Jesus. I remember a story about the great preacher Fred Craddock. Many preachers have told it. It's been used in many sermons. I've never used it before. As a matter of fact, I didn't even use it at 8:30. But I'll tell it now. One time, Fred Craddock, the great preacher, preached on this parable, and a member of the congregation who'd heard him preach came up afterwards and said he didn't care for what he heard. Craddock asked why. And the man said, "Well, I guess I just don't like the story." Craddock asked, "What do you not like about it?" And the man said, "Well, it's not morally responsible." Craddock asked, "What do you mean by that?" "Forgiving that boy," said the man, "it's not morally responsible." "Well," Craddock asked, "what would you have done?" The man said, "I think when he came home, that younger boy needed to be arrested." Craddock asked the man, "Well, what would you have given the prodigal?" Without batting an eye, the man said, "6 years." That would have been fairer, wouldn't it? For taking all of the father's money, or half the father's money, for nearly ruining them. Maybe 6 years would be fair for that level of grand larceny, but it would not be grace. Friends, we want to be fair when it comes to other people who don't do it the way we would like to do it. But we want people to be gracious with us. God's mercy, friends, is not for people who deserve it. If it was, none of us would get it. Because to be mercy, to be grace, it has to be a gift that is given that is undeserved. And we live too often as good church people. We live as people who always want to judge and tell people what they have done wrong. And we want to, particularly for people who don't go to church enough, that don't believe the way we do, or don't think the way we do, we want them to get what they deserve rather than to give the grace that God extends. That kills a church. It's possible for a church building to be filled with people. And yet, if that people doesn't extend grace, it might as well be dead. Because if you don't extend grace, you're not a part of the party. Don Henley, the songwriter, once described us as a people that live in a graceless age. We want God to give us mercy, but we want everyone else to get what they earned. We have churches that are filled with older brothers when our world is starving for grace. We need to remember that if we don't extend grace, we end up starving ourselves. The older brother did not respond to the lost and hurting and broken like the father did. When ones who follow the Father do not give grace like the Father, we break our relationship with the Father. When we refuse to extend grace, we embrace sin. To love the Father means that we extend grace like the Father. If we refuse, we are not transformed disciples of Jesus. We are resentful older brothers who turned away from Jesus. No matter how much time we spend at church. But this just sounds scandalous. This sounds impossible. We can't go around asking the police, judges, and lawyers to give grace all the time. People would get away with everything. Criminal behavior has consequences. Doing life the wrong way has got to have consequences, by golly. This guy who said the prodigal should get 6 years, when you make mistakes, they've got to have consequences. Now, folks, Jesus isn't telling us this story to say that the police need to stop writing tickets, to stop arresting people who have broken the law. It might encourage us to be a little more fair in how we implement justice for those laws. But he's not telling us to stop implementing justice. He's telling us that it's not the government's job to extend grace. It's our job. It's our job to put grace into this world because we have been given grace from the God who covered it, covered the world with his grace. We've been given grace by the God who sent his Son to be that grace for us and to offer us that new life at his table. A Christian that doesn't extend grace is like the older brother, lost in her own resentment, anxiety, selfishness, and self-assurance in his moral superiority. How many of you in person, online, how many of you like to read? Anybody like to read? Some people read with audiobooks. Some people read on their device. Some people read with the good old-fashioned pages. Whatever. There are a lot of folks that like to read. Some of you will understand what I'm saying. I have a set of books. Not a lot of them, but maybe 8 to 10, maybe as many as 15. A set of books that I've read many times. I may read them over again once every couple of years. Maybe once every 3 years, sometimes once a year. Because they've had such a profound impact on me. Some of them are stories. Some of them are writers that challenge me. One of these books in that pile of mine that I read over and over and underline again over and over is a book by Philip Yancey called What's So Amazing About Grace. If you've never read it, I encourage you to pick up a copy. It's 25 years old. You'll be able to find some. I encourage you to get it as an audiobook. Encourage you to get it on your device, whatever works best for you. What's So Amazing About Grace? Yancey's premise is that American Christians do not live as if grace is really amazing. We live as if our first instinct is snap judgments in the face of other person's decisions and life patterns. And oftentimes our judgments are harsh and cruel, even as we sing about amazing grace. If you don't think this is real, just look at our culture. Christians can be some of the most judgmental and cruelest people on social media. If you don't think that we are a culture that is a graceless age, how do we explain some of the harsh ugliness that's come out with Simone Biles? You've read it. You've seen it. I've seen places where she was called unpatriotic, places where she was called weak, places where she was called selfish and not a team player, places where she was accused of not being tough enough to handle things in the bright lights of international competition. You know what's interesting? Not one of those persons was named Simone Biles. Not one of those persons had lived in her head. Not one of those persons, to my knowledge, knew her or had had a conversation with her, and yet they were completely felt free to snap judgment and spit it out everywhere, to their followers, to whoever else. Folks, just shut up. Just hush. We've got to stop spitting out judgment in everything in the world that is none of our business. She gets to make the decision about her own mental health, just like you do about yours, just like I do about mine. We are in a graceless space. It's become cool, accepted to judge others when we have no idea what we are talking about. We need to be extenders of grace, of understanding, of listening. We need to watch our words and maybe just stop talking for a while. Yancey makes the point in his book that Jesus rarely explained grace. He never defined it. What he did was he painted pictures of grace with parables, with stories. What he did was paint a picture of grace with his life, with his death and resurrection. So friends, maybe what we need to do is to make our lives the opportunity to paint pictures of grace for other people, to extend grace to other people. Yancey tells some very powerful stories that go on for pages that I hope you'll read his book, and I hope they will touch you the way they have touched me. But there's one quick story that he tells that I continue to remember and continues to challenge me. It's a story he tells about a group of British scholars, and scholars actually from around the world, that have come to a British conference on comparative religions. And what they were doing at this conference were these scholars were talking about the unique contributions of the different religions of the world. And so a group of Christians came together and tried to answer, what is the unique gift that the Christian religion gives to the world as a whole? And so they tried to come up with things. They said incarnation. And they said, well, wait a minute. There's lots of religions that claim a God becoming a human being. So that's not a unique thing. Now remember, this is an academic conversation. This is not a faith conversation per se about telling our faith story. This is simply about facts about religions. And so one of them says, well, maybe it's maybe it's the resurrection. And another scholar pointed out and said, well, actually, there are other religions that talk about a resurrected deity or a resurrected individual. And so they spun their wheels for a good while, and while they're having the conversation, C.S. Lewis wanders through the room. And in good British fashion, he says, what's all the rumpus about? And they explain the situation to him. They said, we're trying to find and figure out what is the one thing that Christianity offers to all the rest of the world that no other religion does. C.S. Lewis says, that's easy. It's grace. It's grace. Every other religion in the world, in order to come to God's table, in order to connect with God, every other religion in the world makes you earn presence with God. The pillars of Islam, the practices of Hinduism, the path of the Buddha. It is what we do in those religions that earns our salvation. In Christianity, it's not about what we do. It's about what God has done in Jesus Christ. That's grace. Interestingly enough, and about every area of life, every area of our culture rests on. Our judgment for how valuable we are is determined based on how much we earn, based on what we accomplish and how hard we work. It rests on how important and how connected we are, not here. Everything with the followers of Jesus rest on God's gracious love. And if we want to know God, if we want to be in relationship with God, it is all through His invitation of grace and our acceptance of that invitation. Which means we have the responsibility to extend grace to others, just like Jesus. You want to change the course of a church? You want to change a city, a life? The way you do that as a church is to get serious about grace, because our world is starved for it. We can get serious about anything else we want. It is never going to change the world that if we get serious about grace. But I'm going to tell you a secret. If our church decided to get serious about grace, we run a deep risk. And that risk is the older brothers won't want to come in. Because a church that's serious about grace is throwing parties for scoundrels and is welcoming in people that don't deserve it, is welcoming in sinners to be a part of the life of God. That's what the loving Father does. That's what Jesus taught us and embodied for us, and that's what Jesus commands for us to do. Otherwise, we just sit outside the party and stew in the bitterness of our own juices. Let's be a church of grace. Let's be a church of grace. A lot of the church people, a lot of the older brothers may not understand us. But if we really get serious about grace, we'll be like Jesus. And isn't that the whole point? Just Jesus. This table is a table of grace. It's a table where all are invited by Jesus. Where all are invited. Regardless of what you've done, regardless of how far you've wandered away, regardless if you've never wandered away, all are invited to this table and welcomed by the nail-scarred hands of the Christ. The invitation is simple. Come to me, all who are weary, and I will give you rest. I will give you life with me as your liver, as your leader, and as the forgiver of your sin, now and for all eternity. Welcome to the table of God. On the night in which he was betrayed, Jesus took bread, and after he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Take and eat. This is my body, given for you." You didn't earn it. It's given for you, for all of you. As often as you eat this bread, you do it in remembrance of me. This bread, friends, this is the body of Christ, the gift of grace, the bread of heaven. And after supper, He took the cup and he gave thanks for it, and he passed it to all of them, saying, "Drink you this, all of it. For this cup is the blood of the new covenant, given for your sin and the sins of many. Because grace is what God does, it is who God is. God gives gifts, and we have the opportunity to receive." So, disciples, brothers, sisters, friends, neighbors, as often as you eat the bread and drink this cup, you do so in remembrance of the gift of the grace of God in Jesus Christ. In 1 John 1:7, we read this. It says, "If we walk in the light, as Jesus himself is in the light, we have fellowship with God and with one another. And the blood of Christ purifies us from all sin." The blood of Christ, the cup of salvation. At this time, we have an opportunity, all of us, in person and online, to respond to the gracious gift of Jesus. We're going to have a time of worship through song. We're going to stand, we're going to sing. But during that song, you may choose to pray. You may choose to thank God for his marvelous grace. You may choose to confess and say, "God, I have received your marvelous grace, but I have not extended it well. Help me to extend your grace this week." Pastor Walter and I are going to be at the back of the sanctuary, so those of you who are in person who would like to come, we can pray over you. We can talk with you about anything that God is doing in your life, whether it's wanting to become a follower of Jesus for the first time, wanting to know about becoming a member of this congregation, or anything going on in your life, any questions or concerns or anything that God is doing with you. We'd love to pray with you and talk with you. But however God is leading you to respond, folks, this is a time for all of us to respond to God's grace. Let's stand and worship together.